Good morning and welcome to Leftover Grounds. Today we're going to get a bit of a history lesson because I know if you're my age group or younger, at least, none of us were ever required to read Animal Farm or 1984 or anything else from George Orwell because he was considered taboo by that time. I, of course, have read it. I think the guy was a visionary and understood things for what they were. So let's get into it. If you don't know who George Orwell is, we need to have a conversation. At the same time, I know not everybody has read all of Animal Farm or 1984 or any of the other numerous works and articles that he's written. But if you're not familiar with it, George Orwell wrote a book called Animal Farm in the 1940s. And the book really is just a depiction of Stalin and how he took over during the revolution and installed what we know as the USSR. Except for he uses farm animals to depict the process, you know, the pig being the animal who convinces all the other farm animals that they don't need the masters and they should kill them. And, you know, of course, once they do that, they kill off their ability to be fed and things like that. So it just kind of, it's a great book. I mean, it's one of the best books ever written. But what most people don't know is that Animal Farm had a preface written to it. He was asked to write a preface to the Ukrainian Displaced Person Organization. So he wrote a preface in Ukrainian to these people who, of course, his books were banned in Russia and any other Soviet countries. And so he wrote this preface, and I tell you, there's so much in it that's relevant today and interesting, of course. And so I'm going to read some of it. I think it's relevant, and I think it's important for us to understand a little bit of history and to learn from it, of course, and understand that some of these people, I mean, it's hard to say it's not relevant when what he says in this is really a predictor of what's going on right now. So I'm gonna paraphrase a lot of it because it's long. I can't do it all in 10 minutes. I'll go through and kind of paraphrase some of the history of it and get into the meat and potatoes of what's important to what we're talking about today. But he starts out, "I've been asked to write a preface to the Ukrainian translation of Animal Farm. I am aware that I write for readers about whom I know nothing, but also that they probably have never had the slightest opportunity to know anything about me. In this preface, they will likely expect me to say something about how Animal Farm originated, but first I would like to say something about myself and the experiences by which I have arrived at my political position." So this is where I'm going to paraphrase. He was born in India, middle-class family, soldiers, clergymen, government officials, those kind of people. He left school, went to Burma and joined the Imperial Police, did not like it, spent 5 years or so doing that, didn't like it at all, and then ended up traveling, you know, around in Paris, places like that, living on the streets really with poor people and what he called half criminal elements and just kind of taking in life, living hand to mouth, trying to sell his articles. He says, and this is a direct quote, he says, "Up until the 1930s, I did not, on the whole, look at myself as a socialist. In fact, I had yet to clearly define my political views. I became pro-socialist more out of disgust with the way the poor section of the industrial workers were oppressed and neglected than out of any theoretical admiration for a planned society." So he was pro-socialist, not socialist. He got married, him and his wife decided they wanted to fight against the Spanish government in Spain in 1936. And so they joined the POUM militia. It's the Spanish Trotskyists. In the middle of 1937, when the communists gained control, partial control of the Spanish government and began to hunt down. So he's fighting in this revolution. Communists gained control, partial control of the Spanish government. They began to hunt down his group, his outfit, his militia. And so him and his wife both found themselves being hunted. He had been shot through the neck by a sniper. Many of his friends were killed and spent a long time in prison or just disappeared. He says these manhunts in Spain went on at the same time as the Great Purges in the USSR and were a sort of supplement to them. In Spain, as well as in Russia, the nature of accusations, namely conspiracy with the fascists, right? Because you got to remember the communists were fighting fascism, namely conspiracy with the fascist, was the same. And as far as Spain was concerned, I had every reason to believe that the accusations were false. So they're accusing them of being a conspiracy with fascists. That's the excuse they use to round people up, throw them in prison, kill them. He says, as far as Spain was concerned, all the accusations were false. And he was in the middle of it. He was fighting this war. As he says, "To experience all this was a valuable object lesson. It taught me how easily totalitarian propaganda can control the opinion of enlightened people in democratic countries." I find that very interesting. It taught me how easily totalitarian propaganda can control the opinion of enlightened people in democratic countries. This was written in the 1940s. Since my wife and I both saw innocent people being thrown into prison merely because they were suspected of unorthodoxy, merely because they were suspected of it. Yet on our return to England, we found numerous sensible and well-informed observers believing the most fantastic accounts of conspiracy, treachery, and sabotage, which the press reported from the Moscow trials. So guess what? It's nothing new. Been going on for a long time. If it bleeds, it leads, right? He goes on and says, and so I understood more clearly than ever the negative influence of the Soviet myth upon Western socialist movement. Now, he's not even talking about capitalism or democracy. He's talking about the negative influence of what the Soviets were doing by calling themselves socialist when they weren't. They were totalitarian. And he says, and here I must pause to describe my attitude to the Soviet regime. He says, I've never visited Russia, and my knowledge of it consists of what can be learned by reading books and newspapers. Even if I had the power, I would not wish to interfere in Soviet domestic affairs. I would not condemn Stalin and his associates merely for their barbaric and undemocratic methods. It is quite possible that even with the best intentions, they could not have acted otherwise under the prevailing conditions there. He's saying, I wasn't there. Maybe they're forced into it. Who knows, right? He continues on, but on the other hand, it was the utmost importance to me that people in Western Europe should see the Soviet regime for what it really was. Since 1930, I had seen little evidence that the USSR was progressing toward anything that one could truly call socialism. On the contrary, I was struck by clear signs of its transformation into a hierarchical society in which the rulers had no more reason to give up their power than any other ruling class. Moreover, the workers and intelligentsia in a country like England cannot understand that the USSR of today is altogether different from what it was in 1917. It is partly that they do not want to understand, i.e., they want to believe that somewhere a really socialist country does actually exist, and partly that being accustomed to comparative freedom and moderation in public life, totalitarianism is completely incomprehensible to them. They don't want to think about it, is what he's saying. It can't be, right? Never could happen. It says, yet one must remember that England is not completely democratic. It is also a capitalist country with great class privilege, and even now, after a war that has tended to equalize everybody, with great differences in wealth. But nevertheless, it is a country in which people have lived together for several hundred years without knowing civil war, in which the laws are relatively just, and official news and statistics can almost invariably be believed, and last but not least, in which to hold and to voice minority views does not involve any mortal danger. In such an atmosphere, the man in the street has no real understanding of things like concentration camps, mass deportation, arrest without trial, press censorship, etc. Everything he reads about a country like the USSR is automatically translated into English terms, and he quite innocently accepts the lies of the totalitarian propaganda. Up to 1939 and even later, the majority of English people were incapable of assessing the true nature of the Nazi regime in Germany. And now, with the Soviet regime, they are still, to a large extent, under the same sort of illusion. This has caused great harm to the socialist movement in England and had serious consequences for English foreign policy. Indeed, in my opinion, nothing has contributed so much to the corruption of the original idea of socialism as the great belief that Russia is a socialist country and that every act of its rulers must be excused, if not imitated. And so for the past 10 years, I have been convinced that the destruction of the Soviet myth was essential if we wanted a revival of the socialist movement. I find this interesting that Orwell wrote that book in order to revive the socialist movement. That is amazing to me. I had no idea. He says, On my return from Spain, I thought of exposing the Soviet myth in a story that could be easily understood by almost anyone and which could be translated into other languages. However, the actual details of the story did not come by me for some time until one day I was living in a small village. I saw a little boy, perhaps 10 years old, driving a huge cart horse along a narrow path, whipping it whenever it tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their strength, we would have no power over them, and that men exploit animals in much the same way as the rich exploit the proletariat. I proceeded to analyze Marx's theory for the animal's point of view. To them, it was clear that the concept of class struggle between humans was pure illusion, since whenever it was necessary to exploit animals, all humans united against them. The true struggles between animals and humans. From this point of departure, it was not difficult to elaborate the story. I did not write it until 1943, for I was always engaged another work, which gave me no time. He goes on to say, I don't want to comment on the work. It speaks for itself. If it does not speak for itself, it's a failure. But I would like to emphasize 2 points. First off, although various episodes are taken from actual history of the Russian Revolution, they're dealt with schematically and their chronological order is changed. And he said the second point that has been missed by most critics, possibly because I did not emphasize it sufficiently. A number of readers may finish the book with the impression that it ends in the complete reconciliation of the pigs and the humans. That's not my intention. On the contrary, I meant it to end on a loud note of discord. For I wrote it immediately after the Tehran conference, which everybody thought had established the best possible relations between the USSR and the West. I personally did not believe that such good relations would last long, and as events have shown, I wasn't far wrong. I know that this is a lot of reading. I encourage you to read it yourself. But what we're going through is not something that's new. History does repeat itself. We're going through a different type of situation, but I keep trying to talk to my liberal friends and make them understand that what's being pushed right now is totalitarian, and it's the same thing that was pushed, and people will believe it. People will believe what they're told automatically, mostly because they don't want to think about the bad stuff that could happen, especially if they live in a society where they are a bit more comfortable. They don't want to imagine not having that comfort and not being able to live with that. So as we continue on dealing with the nonsense from our different media outlets and the propaganda that is being pushed and is evident to anybody who has eyes to see, I recommend that we continue to go back every once in a while into history and look at what has happened before and learn lessons from it in order to figure out how we can make a difference, how we can affect change, how we can speak the truth to people and get them to accept it and understand it. I still am working on that one. That's a hard one. We have people on this platform right now that are probably going, this is bull crap. I can't believe you're reading from Orwell. Trust me, the guy, I think, this is what I honestly think. I think he wrote a playbook, not purposefully, but that people are using in 1984. If you haven't had a chance to read that, read it. But I mean, a lot of this stuff, it is what it is. I mean, we might not want to look at it and think about it and accept it, but this is where we're at. So I hope you get some out of this. Share this information. Start liking stuff on social media. Get your friends on this platform. If you can, we really need more support. Like I said, I give us about a year and we're going to run out of money. But I do know that the support I get right now, I'm so grateful for. But we need more. We need more people to sign up and pay to support this platform. I need more ideas from you all on maybe what are some other ideas, some other topics, some other people that might want to come on as guests and talk about some of this stuff. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Like I said, I think we need to go into history every once in a while and learn from it. And hey, his books are some of the best books ever written. That's undisputable. So I look forward to your comments, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Come on!